Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a lovely day. It's a lovely day where I am.
And it's a lovely day here.
It may not be a lovely day when people hear this, but it's a lovely day right now.
God, you appreciate it, don't you, after yesterday? Oh, Lord.
You really appreciate it.
Dark and rain. It's fabulous.
Yeah, I went for a walk around the block first thing, and I was in such a good mood. And I passed this lady walking her tiny dog. And, you know, give her a wide berth, COVID berth, so forth, you know. But also, at the same time, you want to be polite, don't you?
Good morning.
I said, it's a lovely morning, isn't it? And as I went past, she said, yes, but the sun's lower in the sky. I thought, say that to me.
That's so British. Yeah,
we've got glass half empty.
We've got six months of this ahead.
Oh dear!
It's that I think you'll find. That sing-song tone in the voice.
Yes,
finger wagging.
Nice.
Oh well,
day.
There we are. She's rained on your parade.
Yeah, she has. Okay, all right. Stagwaddy game.
Stagwaddy game. All right. Okay.
Go on.
British TV music shows, pop and rock, okay, which always had daft names. All of these from the last 30 years, some of them very short-lived, five of them real, one of them a ringer invented by me. Okay,
go on.
Okay, six TV music shows in the UK. Shaker Maker, Pop World, All Right Now, Seven Ages of Rock, Check It Out, and The Noise.
Oh, good God.
All right. I'll read those runners and writers again.
Can I just say they're all uniformly terrible names.
They are all terrible.
Every single one, even the one you made up yourself.
I know. So Shaker Maker, Pop World, All Right Now, Seven Ages of Rock, Check It Out. And The Noise. God. You can imagine the excitement. People sitting around a table, cooking up one of those again. That's it. We'll go with it.
I found myself, first of all, thinking Shaker Maker had to be made up. And then as I thought about it for a second, I thought, no, it might not be. I'm going to go Seven Ages of Rock.
Seven Ages of Rock. Okay. No, Seven Ages.
That was real, wasn't it?
Seven Ages of Rock is real. I'm afraid it's real. Series from 2007.
Wow.
On BBC Two. All Right Now. It was also real. It was a Time T television program in 1979.
Yeah.
Remember, you know that one probably.
I think so.
Check It Out is also real. What a great name.
Check It Out.
Time T's again. The Noise was presented by Andy Peters in 1996.
Of course it was.
All Right Now. Seven Ages of Rock, real. And no, the one I made up was Shaker Maker, actually. Which sounded like one of those things that would have been a brilliant idea at the time, just for a brief moment.
Yeah, for a split second.
A kind of, you know, Brit pop kind of classic. And it would have been all over after one series.
What they should have done, really, is done a live programme called Live Forever, shouldn't they? At the height of Britpop, as in Live Forever.
A very Live Forever, good.
Yeah, you see, I could have had a career in television.
Good.
Anyway.
Wasted.
Okay. Coming back at you.
Give me yours. Yeah, yeah.
I've only got five. Yeah. You've extended it to six. I've only got five. And this is inspired by the quiz we had on Friday night. We have a quiz every Friday evening around 6 o'clock for our Patreon supporters where I give people 10 clues to the identity of a musical artiste and they have to guess who the artiste is from the obscure clues. And the answer to Friday's was Frank Zappa. We were talking about Frank Zappa, weren't we?
We were. What a great and fascinating subject he is.
And one of the clues was the kind of mad titles that Frank Zappa gives his LPs. So what I've got here are five Frank Zappa LPs, okay, titles, one of which is made up, okay?
That's good.
Okay.
That's good. I'm not going to... I know a bit of Frank Zappa, but
But you may not know the further reaches of Frank Zappa.
No, they're all album titles, right?
They're all album titles.
Okay.
Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch.
Yep.
Come on, Punky, get funky. You are what you is.
Hang on a sec. Come on, Punky, get funky, is it?
Yeah. You are what you is.
Yeah.
Jazz from Hell.
Yeah.
And Zoot Allures.
Okay, well, look, Zoot Allures and Ship Arriving Too Late to Save a Drowning Witch, I'm fairly sure are real. I think, am I wrong already?
No, okay.
So we got Jazz from Hell, You Are What You Is, and Come On Punky, Get Funky. Is that right?
Yep.
Those are great. You Are What You Is sounds like, that sounds like Zappa. Jazz from Hell is, I would have thought, precisely the kind of thing that he'd come up with, actually. I'm sorry, I'm going to go for Come On Punky, Get Funky, but I may be miles off.
You're right. Come On Punky, Get Funky is a Frank Zappa bootleg.
Oh, is it?
So it's titled by somebody else.
Oh, that's good.
Attempting to emulate Frank Zappa. So I didn't make it up myself. It's a Frank Zappa bootleg. So they.
What an endlessly fascinating story Frank Zappa is, isn't it?
The thing about Frank Zappa is I never get fed up of reading about him. I can soon get tired of
listening. Probably get tired of listening to him. There aren't that many good records. It's true.
But I love that. It's always interesting.
My favorite story is that he wanted to be for his 15th. Was his 15th birthday? He wanted as a present. He wanted a telephone call to France to talk to Edgar Varese.
His favorite
avant-garde.
He wanted the $5 to pay for the long distance phone call.
That's an amazing and precocious present.
Absolutely. He did so.
Very good.
Anyway, I got up this morning to read the thing in the New York Times. Headline is: How much is an album worth in 2020? $3.49, $77, $1,000, maybe nothing. And it's just based on, it's kind of an interesting story of this this rapper, Rap Ferreira, kind of, you know, marginal hip hop artiste, but he's got a following and he's putting out his own records. And he decided, how is he going to price the record? That was his dilemma, you know, because that's in his gift. It's not a record company. Nobody else decides what we can charge.
And this has been the thing since in rainbows with Radiohead, wasn't it? He started the whole honesty box thing in whatever it was, 2007, wasn't it?
And
pay whatever you want. But he puts a price on it, doesn't he?
Because he goes around looking at what people are prepared to pay on Discogs and, you know, online markets and so forth. And so he had he got a record called Purple Moonlight Pages, and he announced that the vinyl double LP was going to be $77 because he just worked out that's what some people pay for those things, and whenever anybody objected, which of course some people did, say, well, that's a bit much, whatever. He was quite prepared to face him off and say, you know, no, I did this for these reasons. You know, people pay this kind of sum of money. I don't expect everybody to pay it. But, you know, I have identified a kind of hardcore of my support who will pay this kind of thing. And it just made me think it was really interesting, you know. And I was thinking about how with anything, whether it's a record or a book or a magazine back in the day, you know, there was always hardcore who would pay pretty much anything for whatever it was, you know. And then there was a far softer outer area of people who might pay if it was, you know, competitively priced. And so everything grew to get that bigger market. And therefore the product, whether it was a record or a magazine or a book or whatever, was compromised in order to get that wider market.
Yeah. So what this guy's doing, he's just simply concentrating on the kind of hardcore inner core, really, isn't he? Because there was an artist called Hustle who put out 100 copies of his album Mailbox Money and charged $1,000 for each.
That's quite a lot.
And he sold all of them. Now, that's a lot. Obviously, that's a lot. But you could argue that $1,000 for only 100 copies, that they might retain their value. But the thing about Raph Ferreira is they can't possibly retain their value if there's 1,500 of them.
Well,
do you know what I mean? And they're $77 each. I think it's unlikely. And so what he's really doing is he's kind of effectively getting a donation, isn't he, from the artists, the people who value him most.
It's interesting. I was talking this week to James Clutton, friend of the pod, who lives near me, and James runs Opera Holland Park, the opera that takes place every summer in Holland Park, and usually performs in front of about 1,000 people in an air-conditioned marquee erected on the front of Holland House and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, they can't do that this year. And so he has tried to keep it going in some way by having a small number of very select concerts, you know, where their audience, and they can do it with social distancing, they can have 200 people. And, you know, and what you're offering is a far kind of purer experience. You know, you will get nearer to the performer.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there will be less, there won't be kind of spectacular scenery or fabulous lighting or any of that kind of stuff. But if you like the music, if you're the kind of person who wants an evening of whatever it is, you know, Verdi or Stephen Sondheim or whatever, you will pay for that. And so what he's found is that they can release those shows, only a small number of them, and they sell out really quickly.
Yeah.
And I wonder if this is what's kind of happened as a result of all this, is it'll get smaller number of people, arguably a lot more for kind of purer experiences. Mind you, I suppose what happened in the last 20 years is people also paid more and more for more degraded experiences, as we were discussing
recently.
The kind of Hyde
further
Park,
and further back
Hyde
in
Park
stadiums.
Treated like cattle, can't see anything,
A pillar,
that kind of stuff. But I just thought it was a really interesting thing, and it made me think about, you know, the magazine thing, that you know, you still meet people who say, oh, it's such a shame that Word went away and all that. So,
remember the conversation we had about Word? I can remember it distinctly. Word was £5. And we were thinking, well, you know, the ads are going down. We've got to compensate for that at some stage. So the idea was, why don't we double the price? Do you remember that? I mean, it was just a fanciful thought. It was gone in a minute. We thought, why don't we charge £10 for Word? Because the people who pay £10 for it, they're not suffering. They wouldn't do it, or they wouldn't pay £10 if they didn't think it was worth it. They really, really value it to that extent. And if you kept more than half the readers, you'd be making hay. We didn't do it, obviously.
Well, yeah.
But that was the principle.
I mean, I suppose there may have been, I suppose there are examples in the fashion magazine market, weren't there, in the last 10, 20 years, where people did that kind of thing. But I've got the feeling they're not doing it now. Those things have got cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But it is just interesting that with everything, I think there's a hard market and then there's a soft market around.
Completely.
You know, and I wonder if people will end up appealing more to the hard market. I'll tell you what I was thinking about. That was that why wasn't there a kind of window on album releases where, if you want to hear it in the first 6 months, you can only buy the hard copy. It's not streamed.
Oh, right. So that's the same as the hardback, softback format for books.
Well, I suppose it is.
Isn't it?
I suppose it is. You know, that
it's a bit like the cinema release DVD.
If you couldn't hear the Bob Dylan album, except by going and buying it, and it would cost you £30 or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, clearly the hardcore Bob Dylan fans are going to do it. And people who are really attracted by the reviews or whatever, they're going to do it. And loads of people on the outside are going to think, well, I'll wait for it, you know, when it starts to pop up on Spotify or Apple Music or whatever. I don't need it that badly right now. So, you know.
That makes huge sense.
It's just quite interesting the way the way people do these calculations. I get this whenever I have a book coming out, you know, you announce you got a book coming out and it comes out in hardback. You'd always get somebody who get in touch and say, when's it coming out in paperback?
I can't believe that, because, you know, if you really wanted to read it, I mean, hardbacks are instantly reduced to go to $12.99, aren't they?
Well, no, not quite that much, but anyway.
Not far off, you know. No, and well, so And the idea that the paperback's going to be about £8, you're simply saving the cost of one cup of coffee in a Starbucks. You know what I mean? To wait a year to read it, I just can't understand why people do. They just don't like hardbacks.
Maybe I suppose that's possible. And when you consider, the way I look at a book is, if you read it, you presumably enjoy it. And if you've read it and enjoyed it, you have had how much enjoyment?
I know, that's the point. Hours.
Well, I worked it out, because I did the audiobook of my new one. I went to the studio a couple of weeks ago, and it takes over three days to record it. But broadly, it takes 24 hours. 24 hours of sitting at a microphone, saying it, reading it aloud. And so, if somebody's going to read it, it's going to take them longer than that, But let's say 24 hours. And so,
but how spread, much entertainment?
Spread it, out over that. That's 3 weeks or whatever. Yeah. That's longer. That's a month probably in an average person's kind of reading life. So you've had effectively a month's worth of entertainment from it. And so, arguing about tiny questions of whether it's a 50p more or 50p less.
I know.
I mean, I know everybody wants value for money. Fair enough. But, as soon as if I paid a lot for something and it's, if it proves rubbish, that's just really bad luck, isn't it? You're not going to feel any better. If you read a book and you found it really tedious all the way through. Or a better example, you go and see a film and you think it's terrible and you sit there all the time, all the way through, and it's damn near 3 hours long. And at the end of it, you think, well, never mind, I only paid £4.50 for it. You don't think like that.
No, you don't think like that. You think that's three hours of my life. I will never get my back life.
That's the thing.
I know you're furious about it.
Yeah. So
and the other thing about a book is you've paid for it and you can lend it to people and you can go and reread it.
Oh no! Don't suggest people.
That's a very bad idea. No, you don't. Everybody goes out and buys their own copy.
But listen, if anybody wants to read a book and they can't afford it, well, public libraries are there for
it is.
So it is available, but I just think it's interesting the way we all make these kind of calculations.
I know of
value, and I wonder if they're being reviewed at the moment and people are maybe changing their minds about some of these things. I don't know. It'd be interesting to know what people think.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So, Dave, Remain in Love by Chris France, the memoir, which you've read and I've read, and I thought was really good, actually. And two things struck me. One.
Just two
of many. No, there were many things. One was, what a charmed life in every respect Chris France had. The most rapid and untroubled ascent imaginable, really, for talking heads. And secondly, that he and Tina are supreme. Tina Webb, supremely middle class. That incredibly comfortable background they come from. Tina's the daughter of a Navy vice admiral. His father was a colonel in the army. His mother was a Southern belle, who thought Elvis was common. So they're kind of very, very middle class, and he's completely
upper middle, to be
upper
honest.
Middle class. Upper middle class. No, you're right. Upper middle class. And not remotely embarrassed about, Jim Morrison had lots of reasons to be embarrassed about the fact that his father was, I think, a vice admiral, because this was during the Vietnam War. But, but obviously Chris France is not that rebellious kind at all. And the kind of makeup of the group really stand out when they're on the road with the Ramones in 1977 and the tour bus. And it's brilliant. The Ramones are quintessentially rock and roll. They claim they've never heard of salad. They don't know what it is. They sit in, rather artistically, they have to sit in exactly the same seats every day in the tour bus. And they have these fairly prosaic conversations, And there's the talking heads in the back talking about fine cuisine and architecture and stuff. But it's such a charmed life. Then they meet Lou Reed, and he offers them a deal, a record contract. They meet Andy Warhol,
and also they find out that if they'd signed the Lou Reed contract, they would have been bound to him for life.
For life, and got
would have taken them
no money.
Absolutely every penny.
It would have been completely
so much for the fraternity of artists.
Rogered. No, I know, but at least he offered him a deal. You know, Andy Warhol falls over them and makes them a radio ad. The first demo they make, they get offered a recording deal and decide not to make an album until they're a four-piece band. So obviously, it's all about kind of right place, right time. And the other thing that struck me was that it's his portrait of David Byrne. It goes on and on about clearly there cannot be, when David Byrne has read this book, there cannot be a Talking Heads.
It doesn't seem
reunion,
like it.
I don't think, because he really doesn't stop, does he? And he sort of goes on about how this man cannot acknowledge where he stops and other people begin. And he paints a picture of this guy who is just programmed. He is genuinely eccentric. He's completely attention-seeking. There's a scene where they go out, he introduces them to his parents and takes him out for a meal. And David Byrne spends the entire time loading up his knife with peas and rolling them into his mouth. Do you remember that? Oh, God. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. And he's Byrne is competitive, he's controlling, he makes Tina Weymouth cut her hair because he thinks she's too much of a kind of, getting too much visual attention, it's detracting from him. When they make Stop Making Sense, he tells them all they've got to turn up in really toned-down clothes, they're all going to wear toned-down clothes. And then when he arrives, he's got the huge, great white suit on. He's completely narcissistic, he's very jealous of the success of Tom Tom Club. And all of that stuff, and yet not one point does he acknowledge that actually that's what makes David Byrne really interesting.
Yeah.
Because people who write books, particularly in rhythm sections, often simply cannot see what the outside world sees of that group.
There's a classic
example. They've only seen it from the inside. They've never actually stood in the audience and watched.
There's a really classic example of this. If you can find a copy, read the autobiography of Noel Redding, the bass player of the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if it's on the first album, I think there's a Noel Redding song that they used to do early in the set, early in their career.
Yeah.
Noel obviously made it part of the price of his being involved.
Yeah, this is the kind of Boris the Spider equivalent. Yeah.
Well, Boris the Spider was really popular. But
actually,
anyway.
It was very good, actually. Yeah.
But anyway, he did this. And it's either on the first album or second, I can't remember. And in his autobiography, he starts writing about how, well, Jimmy dropped my number from the set because it was going down too well. And you thought, oh, no.
Don't think so.
I don't think that would be what's going on. But that's the lens through which, you know, the bass player is looking at the world as he sees the guy at the front growing in stature.
Absolutely.
And him diminishing at the same time, you know.
But they simply can't acknowledge just how important that, you know, Talking Heads without David Byrne, unimaginable. Absolutely unimaginable.
Doesn't
completely.
Even get started.
I mean, there's a separate issue, the success of Tom Tom Club, obviously without David Byrne, but that's a completely different thing. You know, it's a totally different concept. It's different kind of music, different
but if
focus.
If you've got a band and two members of the band are married to each other, you know, so for a long time now, you know, how long has this been going on? A long time. They've been brooding about David Byrne.
43 years. And stirring it up between each other. Every night getting home from work going,
there's another thing he did.
What's he gone and done now? And you see that thing he did with the peas and his knife?
you go back and you reinterpret absolutely everything that happened in your history.
Would.
In the light of it being his connivance,
in
bringing you down, that's just what people do, isn't it? You know,
it is,
and it's bad enough if it's one member of a group, but if it's one member, you know, husband or wife, you know, they just think every night over dinner they must be saying, "Do you remember that game?" You know, in Edinburgh in 1982.
Absolutely, he only went and did that.
Well, he had
all
there
in a cab with him, and the Talking Heads, the Tom Tom Club's record just come out, and it's announced on the radio that it's doing fantastic. It's a big hit single and selling all over the world. And they're in this cab with David Byrne, and David Byrne's very, very quiet about it and doesn't make any comments at all. And they kind of have a go about how competitive he is. I don't blame him for being competitive, actually. Do you?
No.
I mean, I think that's the way it is. It's, you know, he could have possibly had the generosity to congratulate them, even if he didn't mean it. But I mean, unless you're completely competitive and to some extent narcissistic, you're never going to be that successful a frontman.
But also, it goes back to this lens. If you've decided that he's ungrateful, everything that you're going to, you'll interpret everything as being a sign of his ingratitude.
Absolutely. You know,
it's just the thing you do. You know?
Yeah.
Talking of the Talking Heads, I was just looking at, we were talking about the Talking Heads, and I was digging out an old book called Perfecting Sound Forever, The Story of Recorded Music by Greg Milner.
Oh, yeah.
It's not that old. It's a few years old. And it's just, you know, it's a kind of book that absolutely fascinates me because it's just about how people actually make records. Now, the ways of making records have changed over the years and they don't always chime with the way that we, the public, think records are made. And they talk about the first Talking Heads album. I've got it here, actually. And the book interviews Tony Bongiovi, who was the guy who started the studio that they recorded this album in. And he was involved in both this and the first Ramones album. And he's quite controversial in the book about talking about how much was done after the bands had finished. And, you know,
By which he means completely re-recording bass and lead parts.
Who knows? Yeah. But he claims that, you know, Bob Babbitt, the Motown bass player, was brought in on the Talking Heads record. I don't know if any of that's quite exactly true or the way we think of it, but it just made me think about this whole business of how kind of senior pros are brought in on records all the time and their contribution is very often minimized by the artists. And the seasoned pro is not in a position to go on about it, and it's not in their professional interest to say, oh, I played that bit, I invented that bit, whatever. But I think it's highly likely that they did an awful lot more than people let on. And it's funny, I was reading Frank Zappa book the other day, where he just talked about that whole business of, you know, in the mid-60s, how they made a kind of Johnny Rivers record or, you know, any kind of standard pop record in the mid-60s, is you get the band in to play it, and then you get listening in the control booth proper musicians who would then go in and say, well, it might be better if you just played it a little bit like this or a little bit like that. And they either played along with the musicians or they redid parts after the musicians had gone. And this is why, you know, you ended up with stuff that was fit to be played on the radio, because you have to have a certain amount of kind of polish, don't you?
Yeah.
Things to work on the radio. And Tony Bongiovi talks about in this book, he talks about on the Ramones, you know, first record, and Sheena is a punk rocker and all these kind of things. You know, these were records that sounded great on the radio. And he basically said, if you took a standard band whose playing was as rudimentary as the Ramones and just recorded them as is, it wouldn't sound good enough to be played on the radio. Whereas if you did something with it, if you goosed it in some way, you can make it good enough to play on the radio.
So I wonder how the individual musicians would feel about that. It's a bit like Hey Mr. Tambourine Man by the Byrds, which was, I think, recorded by the Wrecking Crew, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. Jim McGuire, he's the only one on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so how did the others feel? My feeling is that if no one else knew about that, which they wouldn't have done for years, it didn't matter. It made you look good. And also it got you a hit single. Which would you rather have? A hit single? But deep down in your heart of hearts, you would be slightly mortified that you were edited out of the equation. I suppose. I don't know.
It's interesting because I was talking to somebody the other day about, you know, my favorite pop fact of the last few years, which I'm sure we've discussed on podcasts in the past, is that you never get over. I read this in Kenneth Womack's book about George Martin. Kenneth Womack, who we're talking to next week about his book about John Lennon. And I never got over learning that there are bongos on A Hard Day's Night.
You know, can you hear them?
Oh, you can hear them. Once you're told that they're there, you can hear them. Go away and listen to Hard Day's Night. You'll hear bongos. And they were suggested by George Martin because he just felt it needed a bit of extra kind of extra tension in it. And they really do supply it. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. So, you know, all those little touches, which in George Martin's case, nobody said, oh, the Beatles records are played by session men, because he was the producer. He was this guy in a white shirt and tie who came down and played the, you know, play the electric harpsichord occasionally or whatever, you know. But all those little touches were absolutely crucial to making the Beatles records as good as they were. And the Beatles didn't complain about it. And it's also just a natural thing, isn't it? If you're doing anything, if you're doing telly or you're doing a book or you're doing anything, there comes a point where you engage the cooperation of somebody who knows more about it than you do. It's just one of those things. And you don't go, all right, go away now, I'll do it on my own. You're quite happy to take their help, aren't you? You know, but also, making a pop record, it's a cooperative business, isn't it? It's an industrial business.
The Wrecking Crew, no better example of an industrial business. There was a great quote from the late Bruce Gary, who was the drummer in The Knack, who said he was disappointed to find out that his 10 favourite drummers were Hal Blaine. Because his 10 favourite tracks, we discovered later, were all recorded by the Wrecking Crew. He kept thinking, well, that's a great drummer on this particular thing. Oh, the Birds drummer is amazing, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's the way it is. And I suppose will continue to be, you know, but bands want to present themselves as the kind of authentic author of absolutely every noise that's on the record.
The furthest extension of all this was the Frankie Goes to Hollywood record. Do you remember that? The first album? Where only Holly Johnson appears on it, obviously. The other four don't appear. And I'm pretty sure Trevor Horn got in members of Yes and the Blockheads to record it. I think
he would
so.
He would.
And what he did was he recorded the four boys, the other four boys, jumping into a swimming pool. And then, as a sound sample, put that on the album. So somewhere they do actually appear, but only jumping into a swimming pool. That's sweet, isn't it?
Was it Trevor Horn said that when Martin Fry played the original ABC Lexicon of Love demos, he said, well, that's great, but we can do it again properly, you know. And he then went away and they did it again very properly. And I'm sure, you know, Trevor Horn was the person who made the decisions about what was proper and what wasn't.
Completely.
Because if you're sitting in a studio with Trevor Horn, like if you're making a movie with I don't know who, and they know more about it than you do, you're going to say, all right, fine.
You're not going to say, do it my way.
Well, not unless you're singularly stupid, I would have thought, which is, you know, talking of which, I see Jim Corr and Jedward are engaged in a debate about the...
Jim Corr, the man once famously described as the only man in Europe who doesn't fancy the cause.
Very good.
Which I thought was good.
Very good.
What's he gone and done? He's fairly given to eccentric sound offs on Twitter.
He's probably sitting at home not doing my very much. But there's apparently he's very anti-mask. And Jedward a pro-mask. So I thought, you know, what have we come to when the kind of major, you know, philosophical battle in popular music is being waged between Jim Corr and Jedward.
And the idea there that if Jedward say that we should wear masks, how many of us are meeting and think that's what we must do? Good God.
Yeah, well, they are pop stars and their, you know, their word moves millions. But we shall see.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
There's a huge, great feature in the New York Times magazine about a pair of father and son British orthodontists who have come up with some theory that I don't pretend to properly understand about British teeth.
And oh, I saw this. I've read it, yeah.
Facial.
They say that the crooked teeth change the shape of the bone structure of the face and make people look less good looking. That's the thing, isn't it?
And
it's all about the physiognomy, isn't it?
And they have been taken up by the incels on the internet. And of course, you know what incel means, don't you, Mark?
Go on.
It means involuntary celibate. Okay.
Oh, okay.
It means...
This is new to me.
I, young men who can't get any. Okay. Otherwise known in times past as young men. Okay, that's
right.
It's the idea that what we all were when we were kind of 14, 15, now is now a kind of oppressed minority.
Yeah.
You know, that deserves representation on the internet or whatever. But it made me think about the American utter obsession with British teeth. Which British people hardly ever talk about at all.
But in terms of the old the 1960s pop star invasion, George Harrison, David Bowie, Keith Richards. I mean, David Bowie, I mean, who is it? Was it Frank Muir, who had very strange gaps in his teeth, so always said he'd eat an apple through a tennis racket? I think you could probably say the same about some of those guys.
Well, Keith Richards writes about it in his, autobiography quite extensively. And it clearly is a wound that hasn't healed with him, because he's a bit older than I am, and he remembers going to the dentist in the 50s was something you absolutely went to any lens to avoid, because most dentists in that time
were army trained.
Yeah, i.e. they weren't trained. They were not trained. You know, these were people...
Put a knee against your chin to get extra leverage and then get a mole wrench out, you know. I can still remember. Do you remember? I can remember the dentist in the 60s. Do you remember the gas? You'd have gas?
Well, you could have
a tooth out.
I can remember sitting in a dentist chair, and I must have been about 6 years old or something. And my mother was in there with me. And the dentist saying, I can remember, it was the first time I'd heard the word. He said, "Does he want cocaine?"
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they did.
Literally, they would ask that question. Because that meant that they'd give the injection to, you know, which was cocaine. That was the first time I knew of cocaine. And Keith Richards, it haunted him for years. And that's why he's one of those people who just never went to the dentist at all. Just left it alone.
The press comment on his teeth? Because with Bowie, I mean, it was an extraordinary thing, wasn't it? Because if you look at those Bowie albums, he never smiles until the 1990s.
He never smiles.
He kept the old mouth shut in photographs, didn't he? And when he had his teeth done, and he had an amazing American tooth job, or what appears to be one strip of bridge work is kind of laid in, isn't it? Absolutely perfect. From that point onwards, he never stopped smiling. Every single picture of him, you see him laughing, and, you know.
It kind of makes me laugh, you know, that people talk about David Bowie as the ultimate individual, you know. And it was good. As soon as he married a model, you know, day one, when you marry a model, the model gets you in there and says, "All right, now let's have a look at you. We can get that sorted. Yeah. We can get that fixed."
Yeah,
that
a little bit of work needs doing here.
Tick, tick, tick.
Yeah.
And so that's when he got the teeth done. But quite right, if you look at all these early and middle period and classic period album covers, they're all images of him that carefully avoid him showing his teeth.
Showing his teeth.
Because it just wouldn't have worked at all. And of course, I wrote about this in my book, Freddie Mercury had the most... I know he's born in Zanzibar and didn't come to Britain until he was a teenager, I think, or probably a bit before that. But he you know, ran away from the dentist as much as he could. And he had a very strange, you know, arrangement of teeth there.
So he had too many teeth at the back that pushed the ones at the front forward.
That's what
he had, an overbite, didn't he?
Yeah, really pronounced overbite.
Hence the moustache, etc.
But he was also very worried about getting anything done about it in case it changed the way he sang, which is kind of a fair point.
Yeah.
But the story goes that the reason Queen didn't appear on the Bill Grundy programme in 1977 was that Freddie Mercury had finally decided that day to go to the dentist. And it was...
Which is a fantastic irony, isn't it? Because the group that they got on instead was the Sex Pistols, and Johnny Rotten was called Johnny Rotten because of his terrible teeth. I know, it's fantastic, isn't it?
The idea that you embrace the teeth rather than hide them.
Them.
But, no, it's amazing how it just continues to be a big thing. And it's still a thing that the Americans, you know, the average American chat show host still feels perfectly comfortable in making what is, frankly, you know, kind of rude and abusive references to the teeth of people from England or whatever.
But known as it's known as English teeth, isn't it?
And they just say it, you know. Which I don't think is really deserved, actually.
No, but does it tell you something about the difference in the way American and English British audiences connect with people? I don't know. Because there's something about the British audience that want people to be real and unvarnished and approachable and possible to identify with. And there's something in the American culture that wants people to be sort of slightly fantasy, rather perfect figures. Would that be fair to say?
I suppose that might be true. Yeah. I
always used to think of it with magazines, that if you looked at magazines, the time that British magazines are most interested in stars, celebrities of any kind, is when they're first taking off, when they're still a bit like you and they've got all to play for, and then when they're coming back down the other side.
Yes.
They've had the success and it's all gone a bit wrong and they've been returned to their kind of humble old selves, a little bit wounded, a little bit wiser, a little bit sadder, and you can relate to them again. But that middle period, you've kind of lost them. Whereas American magazines, the key period you're interested in is when they're absolutely cruising at that altitude, when they're the most successful. That's the big fantasy.
I suppose that's true.
But there might be something about it. I don't know. I remember interviewing Rod Stewart once, and he talked about you know, physical eccentricities, because he had the nose, and Elton had the hair, and Freddie had the teeth. And they were going to have a band, weren't they? They were going to have a band called Nose, Hair and Teeth.
Nose, Hair and Teeth.
Yeah, I know.
You can't imagine the same conversation taking place in the United States, can you?
Not remotely.
You can't see, you know, Madonna and Bruce Springsteen and, you know, people like that getting together and discussing physical imperfections.
Although Madonna, to be fair, does have one. Madonna has a big gap in her front teeth, which she's never had fixed, and I rather admire her for it.
Very interesting. I know we didn't talk about this on the podcast. Oh, Hilary Mantel wrote a review of a Madonna book in, I can't remember, London Review of Books, I think, recently. A kind of, she wrote this really good, really interesting review of a biography of Madonna. And she took issue with loads of bits of it. But the one thing that she really took issue with was the idea that Madonna was really attractive. And she said, I can't remember the phrase she used, but it was something like, Madonna was the plain girl's revenge, which I thought was a really good idea. She was a girl who wasn't fabulously attractive or anything like that, wasn't fabulously tall or sylph-like or anything, but just made herself into this kind of glamorous figure by sheer force of will, you know. She didn't have the equipment underneath, really, but she said, if I believe that I'm fabulous, if I believe I'm a sex bomb, I will eventually be a sex bomb, even though I'm just kind of a middling girl in my class of the 16-year-olds in terms of attractiveness. I'm going to work really hard, so I'm going to be the most attractive person. I thought it was a really interesting point.
Because it's a really good point.
Nowadays, people take Madonna on her own kind of estimation. Oh, she's fabulously glamorous and beautiful. Well, not compared to a lot of people.
Compared to a lot of people. I mean, a lot of it's wardrobe, isn't it? You know, it's props. You know, not being unkind at all, but I mean, the whole thing about her was just theatrics, wasn't it? It's just spectacle.
I suppose so. So you watched the Laurel Canyon film?
Oh yeah, I did. I thought it was really interesting. Actually, there was one called Echo in the Canyon that came out about 2 years ago, directed by Andrew Slater, and the recent one is by a girl called Alison Elwood, and it's a bit like, you know, those Ken Burns jazz documentaries.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
Ken Burns documentary where he uses Civil War. And he uses stills and tiny, tiny bits of footage if they're available. But mostly does it with stills and voiceover, you know. And that's how she's made this this film, which I thought was quite interesting, really, because all the people she's talked to, which is, you know, the birds and the mamas and the papas and the Buffalo Springfield and members of Love and stuff, you never see them in vision, which actually struck me as being quite attractive, because if you're in your late 70s or whatever, and you know you're not going to appear
this
in a film,
yeah, but
then that makes you far more keen to cooperate, actually. doesn't it? No disrespect to any.
But listen, there's a couple of other things that going on there. And that is the standard way that they make documentaries nowadays.
Yeah, it's true.
And if you go and look at the Maradona documentary, you're going to look at the Ayrton Senna documentary. There's a really good Frank Sinatra two-part All or Nothing at All, I think it's called. If you keep the talking heads out of shot, you don't date at all, because you don't see when the person in their life said this thing. And also, you don't have to go and interview them. You can go and find an old recording of them talking, and you just match it with your pictures.
Because they bring in, she brings in various people who are no longer alive, actually. Yeah. And so, therefore, and you don't immediately think, how did that happen? You know. And also, when you see people, you've got that constant thing of being reminded, if you see Stephen Stills, you're constantly being reminded what Stephen Stills used to look like and how much he might have changed. And that's distracting. David Crosby, you don't need to see that. No. It's nothing to do with the story.
No.
But I thought it was really interesting. I thought there were so many interesting things. One was what a key part of the equation the mamas and the papas are. Yeah. You know, who seem to be emblematic of that whole movement. You know, their male-female lineup, their harmonies, the folk, jazz, you know, blues, rock and roll, the Monterey Pop Festival that they kind of kick-started. You know, the song that seemed to capture the whole spirit of it, California Dreaming. And the Fleetwood Mac-like Love Tangles. Now, do you know, you're up to speed, I'm sure you are. Michelle Phillips went off and had a love affair with Denny Doherty.
Yeah.
Mama Cass was in love with Denny Doherty. Michelle Phillips was married to John Phillips. And then she went off and had a love affair with Gene Clark. It's so of the time. It's Fleetwood Mac, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Extraordinary. There's various other things that Love couldn't play the Southern States because of the racial mix-up of their makeup of their lineup, which I was unaware of that. And I was unaware that they got Jack Holzman in to see the Doors. You probably know this story, and said, you've got to sign this band. They partly wanted him to sign the band to get themselves off Elektra. But what happened was it completely scuppered their career. And their husband signed the Doors and then took all the promotional money that he would have then funneled into, to some extent, into Love and shoved it into the Doors. So that completely upended their prospects too. The impact of Joni Mitchell, fantastic.
But
Joni Mitchell arrives, completely different league. Sorry, what were you going to say?
But also I don't think there's another example in popular music of a kind of movement so identified with such a tiny little place.
Yeah.
You know, Laurel Canyon. I've written about this recently in my book. When Graham Nash goes with the Hollies in 67, 68, something like that, he meets Mama Cass. And Mama Cass picks him up at the hotel and drives him in an open-topped car. You imagine this. This is somebody from Manchester. This is somebody from Salford this happens to. And she picks him up.
And introduces
him. She drives him up into the canyon. And you've been up Laurel Canyon.
Yeah.
You know, and even, and I went there in the 70s when it was slightly less gated community than it is now. But there's these fantastic houses up on stilts, these wooden houses with these kind of balconies overlooking, the winding road up there. And she drove him up there up to David Crosby's place. And so David Crosby's out on the patio with the guitar and looking the part and rolls him the biggest joint anybody had ever been rolled. And Graham Nash, you know,
who had never smoked dope at that point in his life.
Never smoked dope. Right. Suddenly is in that place with that view, with those people, and thinks, this is
going home.
This is the life I want to live forevermore. Yeah, forever and also, you can write songs about this place.
Yeah.
And that's the amazing thing about Laurel Canyon, is the kind of, we utterly forgive the kind of supposed self-indulgence of it, because we thought it was fantastic that Joni Mitchell wrote a record called Ladies of the Canyon, and it was all about her and her neighbours. And the fabulous life that they led that we would never lead at all. We thought that was absolutely
great. We thought it was fine. We thought it was a classic fantasy.
Yeah, yes.
But Joni Mitchell changes the whole gear, I think. You know, if you think how from the very beginning, everything about her was different. The way she wrote songs, the way she wrote lyrics, the tunings of her guitar, everything, the way she looked, the fact she was a solo artist, she had these hundreds and hundreds of songs, and they're all completely knocked out with her, aren't they? I mean, David Crosby never quite recovers from meeting her. Graham Nash, I don't think, has recovered to this day.
No, I'm sure.
I mean, they meet, and then he says, I'm a songwriter, you know, here's some of my stuff, and she then plays him 15 songs that she's written that are yet to come out, and he just thinks, this is all over.
But can you imagine? Can you imagine the ego it requires? Going back to our discussion of David Byrne.
Yeah.
The ego requires to go, here are 15 songs. You know, you don't do two. You go, no, here's another one. Oh, and you want to hear this one and this one. Imagine doing that in front of a fellow artist. it's a pretty remarkable thing to do.
It is.
She clearly just had that kind of insane confidence. Well-founded confidence.
Absolutely. Oh, it's a brilliant! It's a brilliant film. Lovely footage of Neil Young on Canadian TV. Very, very polite. Very eager to please. A little roll neck sweater. Keenly introducing all the members of Buffalo Springfield to the presenter. Stuff like that. You suddenly see the change in these people. You know.
Yeah. And
I thought it was great. I thought there's no bigger contrast to right now. You know, everything in the film is easy and it's solvent and it's optimistic and it's uncomplicated and it's uncompetitive and it's really wonderful, sunny, fabulous little vista that you go and revisit. And I thought it was great, you know, up till the point where they all wake up and start thinking about the outside world and how they ought to be writing songs about Vietnam and stuff. But it's brilliant. It's great escapist viewing. It's recommended highly.
The Word Podcast, two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
This is your weekly reminder, if you're not already one of our Patreon supporters, that we'd very much like to see you add your name to the list and take advantage of the many special benefits that flow to those people, including being in the room when we record further Crowdcast Word in Your Ear recordings, as we got coming up over the next week or so with Kenneth Womack, his book about John Lennon, 1980, The Last Days in the Life, where we were talking to him from New York. And a week later, Justin Quirk, his book, Nothing But a Good Time, which is about the spectacular rise and fall of glam metal. Well, we'll be talking to him from somewhere else in London, I would imagine. Other things you can do is, if you sign up to be an annual Patreon, you can get a 15% discount. And we also, at the top level of our Patreon supporters, we do offer the facility of recording your own, visiting your own home for your own very special Word in Your Attic, which is something to celebrate your birthday as it comes round. But also other benefits, like in taking part in our regular Friday night Do You Know Who It Is Yet quiz, the next one coming up next Friday. So all this and more can be yours if you go and look on patreon.com/wordinyourear. So who's added their name?
We just announced the annual patron opportunity, and Robert Markwick has signed up. Bless him.
Yeah,
and we also have new patrons, Mark Alexander, Gareth Moore, NJ Waite, and our 200th subscriber, 200th patron, Michael Holmes. Superb.
Very
many
good
thanks
work
to all of them.
Many thanks, and we'll see you in the next week. Cheers.
See ya. Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.